this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story that reads, YY's Next Move. 50 years ago, IBM planted its flag in the Triangle and drove much of the economic growth that followed. Today, led by CEO Yuanqing Yang, Lenovo is poised to repeat history. And then inside of the Triangle Business Journal, the article actually starts with another headline, On the Offense, How Lenovo is Going Out to Rule the World. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. Lenovo is on the attack. Flush with cash, the world's largest personal computer maker's global strategy, for now, is to grow through acquisitions. And the Triangle is positioned as the command center of this hungry global giant that in 2014 alone has gobbled up more than $5 billion in companies to increase its market share in everything from mobile to servers. The goal isn't to be the next Apple or HP. The goal is to be something Apple and HP have never been. A global leader across all verticals with a nerve center in the Triangle. I believe that Lenovo will have an important role in the RTP area, says CEO Yuanqing Yang, known to all as YY. His plan, to have this area to become a more innovative area, not only in the United States, but also in the world. The success of ThinkPad, the PC brand Lenovo inherited from its acquisition of IBM's PC division in 2005 is proof, he says. Now he's out to prove that Lenovo can replicate that growth in other sectors. For the Triangle, Lenovo's deliberate corporate strategy could not have come at a better time. The Raleigh-Durham area may be on everyone's best place to be list, but the area lacks in high-profile corporate headquarters. The Triangle area may be home to some of the country's best universities, but its innovators struggle for capital on both sides of Interstate 40. To fully grasp the precipice on which Lenovo is poised, look back 50-odd years to the day IBM decided to bring its U.S. manufacturing headquarters to Research Triangle Park. Soon thereafter, suppliers, vendors, and workers came from all over the world, and universities flourished with diversity. Today, Yang holds the key to the region's next round of explosive growth. He's 49, has owned a home in Briar Creek since 2008, has a child in school in Durham, and though he travels more than he'd like, he calls Raleigh home. YY at the helm. Yang doesn't use words like maybe, and he won't detail the steps Lenovo will take to be the region's next big blue. He just says it will happen. Those who work with him say he's used to getting what he wants, and what he wants is to grow in the Triangle. Yang has the money and the support to do just that. Lenovo's profits through the 9 months ending in February exceeded $650 million. A good portion of that bounty will be used to buy companies that will further the company's brand and market share in the U.S. and around the world. In many ways, Yang is chief rainmaker for Lenovo. A salesman who joined the company in 1989, he quickly rose to CEO before deciding to step down in 2005, though he remained chairman. His retreat didn't last. Yang and Lenovo founder Liu Chuanzi returned in 2009 to steer the electronics giant through the global financial crisis. After righting the ship, Chuanzi retired and Yang took the helm. One of the company's largest shareholders, the government of China, also plays a pivotal role in Lenovo's American expansion. It, too, expects Lenovo to become a global giant. The government holds a 36% stake in Lenovo's parent company, Legend Holdings. China's involvement in Lenovo is likely to complicate the company's ability to grow here without U.S. government interference. Technology is a large and critical piece of national security these days, and allowing such a large chunk of it into Chinese hands isn't likely to come without a fight in Washington. In the meantime, though, Lenovo's 10-year courtship with the Triangle continues in its honeymoon phase, but the bond is gaining strength with each year that passes. Yang, ever bullish, tells us he won't be surprised to one day have more than 10,000 Lenovo employees here as he steers the next phase of Triangle innovation. Protect and attack. In 2005, Lenovo came out of nowhere and bought IBM's PC business for $1.25 billion. At the time, few in the United States, much less the Triangle, knew much about the firm, except that it was Chinese, a fact that gave regulators, even 9 years ago, pause. Lenovo then scattered in offices and purchased New York, Beijing, and Raleigh, could have settled anywhere, but it planted itself in Morrisville, attracted, Yang says, by the low cost of living and the seemingly impossible balance of the work and life that North Carolinians seem to possess. Immediately, the company launched its strategy, in which Lenovo expands market share at the expense of profit. Profits, Yang has said, come later, but market share can't wait. It was a tough strategy. As the firm traded profits for market share, cutbacks followed. In 2009, 2,500 jobs were lost, including 100 in the Triangle. But building on the ThinkPad brand, Lenovo crept past institutional players, HP and Dell. In 2007, Lenovo was the third largest PC maker in the world. 5 years later, it was number one. For years, Yang was bullish about his protect and attack strategy, protect Lenovo's dominance in China while attacking the Western market. These days, he's protecting the company's PC moneymaker as he attacks two new vertical products, servers and smart devices. Going West. On a cool morning in January, Don Doyon, Vice President and Director of Acquisitions at Philadelphia-based Rubenstein Partners, got the call. Lenovo, which already occupied three buildings at its Morrisville headquarters, was on the hunt again, searching for space to fit the 2,000 employees that its second IBM acquisition, Big Blue's RTP-based low-end server division, on January 23rd, would bring. Lenovo was eyeing the former Ericsson property at Research Triangle Park, jointly owned by Rubenstein and Charlotte-based Grubb Properties, and it wanted a deal. The 450,000 square foot deal, just 5 weeks, incredible for a transaction of this size, Doyon says. But as the Triangle is finding out, Lenovo isn't used to waiting. Just 6 days later, Lenovo paid $2.9 billion for Motorola Mobility, which brings a recognized U.S. brand to a company that sells more smartphones and tablets across the globe than PCs. This acquisition changes the game, giving Lenovo instant access to the Western smartphone market, with facilities in Illinois and California to go along with its global footprint. And it brings the U.S. front and center in Lenovo's strategy. Morrisville, which Lenovo leaders call a dual headquarters, may not house Motorola, but it's home to the nerve center of Lenovo's American business. And with the former Ericsson property deal, Lenovo gets another nerve center, this time for enterprise to cater to large businesses with a complete suite of servers and PCs. The combination, for the first time and even as executives publicly distance the company from its Chinese roots, gives Lenovo's footprint a decidedly Western slant. We're a global company, says Jerry Smith, Executive Vice President of Lenovo's Americas and Business Enterprise Groups. Chinese delicacy. Of course, meshing cultures from across the globe is always a challenge. That's where culture study comes in, says Grace Young, CEO of Savvy Marketing Group and an advisor to the North Carolina Chinese Business Association, who says Lenovo is taking the right steps to blend in. Executives are embracing Western culture, learning English. They're becoming part of the community of North Carolina. But a perception of China as a watchful and active player in the global marketplace, some might say agitator, still exists. Some of that is warranted, says Young, who is not affiliated with Lenovo. She talked to executives who do business in China who feel they are scrutinized by Chinese executives. Some of that paranoia, she says, could be directed toward Lenovo's executives and the company's Chinese heritage. China is a powerful, powerful machine that can do whatever it wants in a heartbeat, so I think that some of the things that are going on, they may sound paranoid. But I've gotten some data that people feel like they are being watched, Young says. So certainly here in North Carolina, many people think jobs have been taken on the manufacturing side by China. So I see where there's that sentiment there. Lenovo sees that too. That's why the company has started a manufacturing line at its facility near Greensboro, enabling Lenovo to affix a Made in North Carolina sticker on certain PCs. It has also started company-wide charity projects, including Habitat for Humanity builds and computer donations to public schools. One person Lenovo doesn't have to win over is Morrisville Chamber of Commerce President Carlotta Ungaro. They raise our clout, she says. They create more demand for goods and services in the area. It's just great to have that kind of company here. Another champion is North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory. I think it's the next Hewlett-Packard, the next IBM, the next Microsoft, McCrory says. We're benefiting from their USA headquarters, their large manufacturing presence. We're getting the best of both worlds. Concern in Washington. Federal regulators won't be as easy to impress as state economic development folks. While analysts seem to believe both the IBM server acquisition deal and Lenovo's bid for Motorola's smart device business will close, neither will come without considerable interference from the U.S. government. U.S. officials in 2005 made public their reservations over Lenovo buying IBM's PC business, with Republican House members expressing concern the sale, quote, may result in certain U.S. government contracts with or involving personal computers being fulfilled or participated in by the Chinese government. First, this transaction may transfer advanced U.S. technology and corporate assets to the Chinese government, read a letter sent to U.S. Treasury Secretary John Snow and signed by Representative Henry Hyde of Illinois, who was the chair of the U.S. House International Relations Committee at the time. Second, this transaction may transfer licensable or export control technology to the Chinese government. Less than 2 months later, however, the Committee on Foreign Investments in the U.S., a multi-agency panel that evaluates acquisitions of American companies by foreign entities, approved the Lenovo buy. Management challenges. Regulations aside, a $5 billion in deals done in just 6 days is a lot to process. While analysts viewed the IBM server deal as a continuation of the PC acquisition from 2005, they weren't so keen on Yang's company buying Motorola, a business that lost $1 billion last year. If it were to make the same loss again, that would wipe out any profits made at Lenovo, says Jean-Louis Lafayette, an analyst at G Asia in Hong Kong. That's largely why the stock market reversed its upward course after Yang's Motorola announcement, with Lenovo shares dropping 16% amid the belief that Motorola may have found a sucker in Lenovo. And it's not just the Motorola business plan that gives analysts pause. One of the concerns is it's going to take a lot of management time, says Lafayette. Here you have two major acquisitions. The two businesses are quite distinct, operate in two different segments of technology. And with Motorola Mobility based in Chicago, the logistical distinctions could present a challenge attempting to integrate it into Lenovo culture. Smith and others point out, however, the company has done it before. The 2005 IBM PC purchase was met with raised brows. But they maintain that brand asset for the ThinkPad, notes Gartner PC analyst Mika Kitagawa, which is remarkable because it is very different to maintain a brand asset. ThinkPad is one of the best brands in the professional device market now, and they're trying to expand it beyond just the laptop. It has outlasted even HP, even after an HP merger with Compaq that was supposed to create an $87 billion global technology leader. It has also outlasted Asus and Acer, and has left Dell scrambling for both market share and a contingency plan. This time, however, it's a multi-front war, with smart devices on one side and PCs on the other, and Lenovo is on the offense at both ends, and well aware that the deck favors established players such as Apple and Samsung. Yes, it will be a lot of work, Smith says. We know, we've skinned our knees before. It's those bumps and bruises, he says, that will fuel the next assault. We're not going to sit still, he says. Our competitors are making noise out there, but I'm going to put them on notice. We're coming, and we're coming hard. We're going to grow the business, and we're going to attack. And also as part of this cover story, there's a section called Stakeholder Voices, Impressions from Company, Community on Lenovo's Growth. And first we start with Yang King Yang, Chairman and CEO, Yangqing Yang says Lenovo is on track to grow in the U.S. We will definitely leverage these two acquisitions to further grow in other markets, so in the future, China and the U.S. will be our two largest markets, no doubt about that, he says. Yang says it will happen with the talent already in place at IBM and Motorola, noting he plans to leverage this talent to do more business rather than view the talent as a burden. That's our philosophy, he says. And Lenovo's philosophy has a lot to do with the enormous challenges the company faces in integrating products and services run by different people located in different continents. As Yang notes, the integration's three-legged stool includes being frank, being respectful, and being willing to compromise. If people in the U.S., China, and other parts of the country can accomplish that, Yang is convinced Lenovo will become a global player sooner rather than later. And the RTP area will play a bigger role than ever. We are committed to North Carolina and the RTP area, he says. Next is Jerry Smith. Jerry Smith is president and executive vice president of Lenovo's Americas and Business Enterprise Groups, is bullish about Lenovo's future as a global company. We're not a Chinese company, he says. We're a global company. We want that presence and infrastructure in place that demonstrates it. That's what those blockbuster acquisitions will help drive home, acquisitions that have a combined total of more than $5 billion for IBM's low-end server division and for Google's Motorola mobility business. We've already started the integration process, he says. It's going to take some time. We're going to bring value to a different approach to the customer base and the industry. We're going to repeat what we did in 2005. And he knows the stakes are high. This is a big bet, he says, pointing to the $2.3 billion price tag of just the IBM server business. We take that very seriously. We know this investment is the right investment, and we know that being a major player in enterprise in the future is important. We're going to make mistakes. Everyone does it. It's the guys that know how to recover from those mistakes that are going to succeed. And next is Governor Pat McCrory, who calls the firm the next Hewlett-Packard, the next IBM, the next Microsoft. They are visionary and they are very competitive, he says. They realize that whatever they have today, they need to be ready to change for next week, that the existing product needs to constantly change to keep up with the ever-changing environment that's the challenge of that industry. One minute you can be on top of the world and the next minute you can be swallowed up. And their adaptability is their biggest asset, he says, pointing to the fact that they're not resting on their PC prowess and instead investing in tablets and smartphones. The big prize that McCrory is eyeing, the jobs Lenovo is saving with its IBM server acquisition. As IBM shrinks, Lenovo picks up some of those jobs. To have a company like Lenovo get the spin-off of that and get the investment here in North Carolina is extremely beneficial. And next is Bob Giolis, CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation, who says Lenovo could do for the park today what IBM did decades ago. I think Lenovo could do that, he says. We, of course, we're a more diverse park today than we were when IBM came in. We have different companies that define us in different ways. But there's no question the size of this project, the fact that Lenovo has such ambitious plans. I actually visited the Lenovo Center when I was in China, and some of the technologies that I haven't even seen in the American market are just fabulous. It clearly is going to play a big role in our future. And Lenovo's decision to play a part in that future, specifically by choosing the Ericsson campus in RTP for its upcoming expansion, validates RTF's park invigoration effort, he says. And finally, we have Carlotta Ungaro, president of the Morrisville Chamber of Commerce, who says Lenovo gives Morrisville clout. They are Morrisville's largest employer, she says. It's domiciled in Morrisville. They have the North American headquarters there. It's treated as a global headquarters by Lenovo, and that raises our clout. And it's not just any job creator. These are great jobs, she says. These are high-paying jobs that just add to the wealth of our community here. And finally, with this article, there's a timeline that shows how the company came to be. Look, it's headlined Lenovo Through the Years. Starts February 2011. IBM sells the last of its Lenovo stake. June 2011, Lenovo offers to buy German electronic equipment supplier Medion for $900 million. September 2011, Lenovo releases plans to build a massive global headquarters park in Beijing. January 2012, Lenovo announces it's expanding its Whitsitt distribution center. May 2012, Lenovo invests $800 million into a mobile product facility in China. July 2012, Lenovo invests $30 million into a factory in Brazil. Lenovo kicks off its sponsorship of the NFL. August 2012, Lenovo announces a new partnership with EMC that will allow the computer maker to bring servers to market and embed them into EMC storage systems. September 2012, Lenovo pays $148 million for Brazilian electronics maker CCE. Lenovo announces it is buying cloud computing software company Stoneware, based in Indiana. October 2012, Lenovo announces it is building a U.S. personal computer production line, its first, at the Whitsitt facility. Lenovo starts selling its smartphones outside of China, starting with India. July 2013, both Gartner and IDC rank Lenovo as the number one PC manufacturer in the world. January 2014, Lenovo announces plans to acquire both IBM's low-end server business and Google's Motorola mobility business. And March 2014, Lenovo confirms a Research Triangle Park expansion plan, announces it is buying $100 million worth of mobile patents from Unwired Planet. And now we turn to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The headline that starts it off is Sweet Beginnings for Umstead Chef. Daniel Benjamin, the inventive pastry chef at the five-star Heron's Restaurant and Umstead Hotel in Cary, will be leaving the celebrated restaurant to open his own bakery and pastry shop in downtown Raleigh this spring called Lucette Grace. Lucette Grace, a name derived from a mashup of his daughter's middle names, will be located in a former CrossFit gym building at 235 South Salisbury Street, and Benjamin promises it will be different from any other pastry shop in the region. Our product line will be rooted in the classics, but not in an appearance you're expecting, he says, noting also that they will be offering light breakfast and light lunch options during the week. He's also not in a rush to leave the Umstead, his culinary home for the past 7 years. Benjamin was among the first people hired for its kitchen staff, and he says he plans to stick around until at least Easter. Piedmont invites NYC sommelier for dinner. Before he started his own wine collection, Andre Mack was named Best Young Sommelier in America in 2003 by Food and Wine Society Chant de Rotisserie and was head sommelier at Thomas Keller's New York City restaurant. Now he's bringing his wine collection to Piedmont Restaurant in Durham for a five-course meal and wine pairing and tasting. On April 17, dishes will be served that include cured mackerel, duck bresaola, toasted farro verde, rack of lamb, and rhubarb pie. These dishes will be paired with wines from Mac's collection. Mac has been featured in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Stahl Brothers love their Canadian golf tourney. The Stahl Brothers will be swinging a different kind of stick in July than they are used to as members of the Carolina Hurricanes now that they've signed on through their foundation as the title sponsor for the Thunder Bay Golf Classic, part of the PGA Tour Canada. The tournament will be called the Stahl Foundation Open, presented by T-Bay Dell. When we heard PGA Tour Canada was coming to Thunder Bay, we jumped at the chance to attach our name to the event, said Eric Stahl, the elder brother. It's going to be a really exciting week of sport and entertainment, and we think the Stahl Family Foundation is a great fit. We love our hometown, and just like PGA Tour Canada, we're passionate about family, charity, and our community. The Stahl Foundation Open, presented by T-Bay Tell, is the sixth tournament on the newly expanded 2014 PGA Tour Canada schedule. And now we have a section, Tweets of the Week. Thank you, hashtag NYC, for the warm welcome, and hashtag Raleigh for expressions of gratitude. Too many comments to respond to. Read them all, and I'm grateful. That's from Mitchell Silver, Director of Planning Development, City of Raleigh, who recently announced he's taking a job in New York City. My bracket is ruined, but I'm okay with that. Smiley face, WTG, hashtag Mercer, at Mayor Mark, Mayor of Chapel Hill. Duck, duck, goose, what's with all the geese in hashtag Kerry, and what can the town do? That's from Lori Bush, Kerry, Town Council member. And in the Did You Know section, North Carolina ranks third in the nation in the amount of tips left for servers, according to a study of tens of millions of transactions by payment service Square. The top tipping states, Alaska, 17%, Arkansas, 16.9%, North Carolina, 16.8%. The worst tipping states, South Dakota, 15.3%, Hawaii, 15.1%, and Delaware, 14%. Average tip in the U.S., 16.1%. Note, tips analyzed by Square are those from credit cards, not cash, which may make the averages higher than if all transactions were included. And finally, in the Team Spirit section, Channel Advisor doesn't just watch March Madness. The Morrisville e-commerce firm lives it, with its local employees donning school colors and really loud NCAA spirit. CEO Scott Wingo even modeled a red wig to showcase his Wolfpack pride. Sorry about that, Scott. Not even Biz saw that loss coming. And now we turn to the A Better World page, and we start with the column written by Todd Cohen. It's headlined under the affordable housing section, CASA brings homeless indoors. Growing up in Duplin County in rural eastern North Carolina, Deborah King learned about the interdependency of people in a small farming community. For the past 19 years, King has tried to put that lesson to work as CEO of CASA, a Raleigh-based nonprofit that develops and manages more than 300 units of affordable housing at 37 properties in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties for people with disabilities or who are homeless, many of them veterans. Formed in 1992 by the Wake County Area Mental Health Program, an agency that worked to ensure that indigent people receive proper care for mental health, substance abuse, and developmental disabilities, CASA now operates with an annual budget of $3 million and a staff of 26 people. Its staff includes 10 part-time employees who are residents of its housing and serve as the landscaping crew for its properties. The agency has a separate budget of roughly $2.5 million a year, mostly from public funding, to develop new housing. This year, it is developing 10 single-bedroom units on Sunnybrook Road in Raleigh, where it already has 10 units. It also has begun construction on 11 single-bedroom units at the intersection of Sedgefield and Guest Roads near Northgate Mall in Durham, in the first phase of a complex that will house homeless veterans and include indoor community space, a laundry room, and outside sitting area. The Durham complex will be named for Alexander B. Denson, a retired magistrate judge from the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. Denson, who in the 1990s served as the third chair of CASA's board of directors, helped spearhead efforts to develop a shelter in downtown Raleigh that could house homeless people on cold nights. The Denson apartments for veterans will cost $1.4 million, most of it public funding, but also including $75,000 from the Home Depot Foundation, because it will house veterans, and $46,500 from a foundation that wishes to remain anonymous and supports green or environmentally friendly buildings. CASA also is seeking $27,000 in private donations to cover landscaping costs, as well as furniture and equipment for the community room. Missy Hatley, former director of annual fund and communications at Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, joined CASA in January as its first full-time director of development and has a goal of raising $85,000 in the fiscal year that ends June 30. In November and December, CASA held its first fundraising appeal to individuals and plans another in April. With a waiting list of more than 500 people, King says CASA aims to engage individual donors in helping to make sure homeless people have a safe place they can call home. If we could replicate that in our more urban environments, that sense of community and responsibility for one another, King says of the interdependence among people she saw as a child raised on a farm, we'd solve so many of our issues. Todd Cohen publishes Philanthropy North Carolina at www.philnc.org and is a contributor to the Triangle Business Journal. And in the nonprofit news section, Eat Subs support a worthy cause. All 25 Triangle Area Jersey Mike's Subs locations donated 100% of their sales from March 26 to the V Foundation to culminate its fourth annual month of giving. Last year, the Triangle's Jersey Mike's locations raised $80,000. Throughout March, Jersey Mike's customers were able to contribute to the V Foundation in various increments and receive Jersey Mike's discounts in return. For example, customers who donate $1 receive a $1 off coupon for their next visit. Lawyers provide free phone counsel. Attorneys from around the state answered legal questions at no charge during the 7th annual For All Statewide Service Day, a program of the North Carolina Bar Association Foundation and the North Carolina Bar Association. There are many people in North Carolina who have questions about legal matters but cannot afford to hire an attorney, said Dan Hartzog, Jr., a partner with Cranfill, Sumner, and Hartzog LLP's Raleigh office. Thanks to the annual For All Statewide Service Day, these people have an opportunity to have their legal questions answered by an attorney at no cost. And now we turn to the reporter pages. And first we have the page of Amanda Hoyle. And it starts off with the headline, Old Chatham Has a New Cottage Industry. The Old Chatham Golf Club in Durham is joining an elite group of private clubs across the country, catering more to their traveling golf members. In early April, Old Chatham will finish construction on the first of three planned cottages at the club site that will offer overnight accommodations for members and their guests. The 2,700-square-foot Birch Cottage will have four bedrooms, each with its own bathroom, a spacious living area with fireplace, and a kitchen with a 10-foot-long granite top bar stocked with snacks and drinks. The cottage is estimated to be valued around $750,000. The idea behind it always was to have a place for members and their guests to stay and a way to help us attract more North Carolina members and more national members, says A.L. Hobgood III, a founding member of the club and leader of the board's building committee. About 25% of Old Chatham's 350 club members live more than 150 miles from the golf club, says Jody Tata, director of development at Old Chatham. These are mostly business executives who work for national and international companies who require frequent travel to the Triangle. Raleigh custom builder Duncan Ray is the builder of the cottage. And in the retailing section, Edible Art moving to North Hills. Edible Art Bakery and Dessert Cafe, one of Raleigh's oldest bakeries at more than 30 years in business, is moving from its longtime home at the Royal Bakery building on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh to North Hills this fall. The new Edible Art location will be next to the Coquette Brazier restaurant at the entrance of the main district at North Hills. 618 Bistro reopens with a new name. Brown paper is covering the windows at the 618 Bistro restaurant at the Marketplace at Lake Boone in Raleigh after the restaurant shut its doors on March 15. A new ownership group led by Taste restaurant owners Justin Miranda and Ryan Rieck are planning to open a new concept in the 618 Bistro space called The Oak, which is expected to open in April. Fat Daddy's closing after 29 years. The owners of Fat Daddy's Market and Grill at 6201 Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh will be closing on March 30 after 29 years in business. Co-owners John Vick and Brad Hurley have decided to sell the building to a Florida development group. And finally, on this page in the Property Matters section, New Wake Forest Development starts clubhouse construction. With construction at the Heritage Golf Community winding down, construction at the adjacent Traditions at Heritage Community in Wake Forest is ramping up. Several model homes have already opened in recent weeks, and construction has begun on the clubhouse, pool, and amenity area, which will feature a resort-style saltwater pool, a tanning deck with misters, a pavilion amphitheater with a fire pit, a sand volleyball court, and a playground. And on the page of reporter Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals, the first article, Duke Health to pay $1 million to settle false claim suit. Duke University Health System will pay $1 million to resolve allegations that it improperly charged federal government health care payers, including Medicare and Medicaid, although the health system did not admit fault. Duke was accused of billing the government for services provided by physician's assistants during coronary artery bypass surgeries when the PAs were acting as surgical assistants, along with graduate medical trainees, which is not allowed under government regulations. And two, increasing billing by unbundling claims when unbundling was not appropriate, specifically in connection with cardiac and anesthesia services. The settlement announcement came jointly from the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina, Thomas G. Walker, and North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper. Allegations of health care fraud will be zealously pursued in North Carolina, said Walker in a statement. Duke University Health System was forthcoming with the information and was cooperative in the investigation and resolution. According to state and federal officials, the allegations resolved by this settlement arose from a whistleblower lawsuit filed under the False Claims Act by Leslie Johnson, a former employee of Duke, PRMO LLC, doing business as Patient Revenue Management Organization. In response, Duke released the following statement in full. We investigated these issues thoroughly, reviewed them with the appropriate government officials, and were able to narrow the areas of concern to those reflected in the government's amended complaint. Duke had no intent to submit inaccurate claims and denies that it violated the False Claims Act. For settlement purposes only, we have agreed to pay back to the Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE programs payments received over a 6-year period for claims that resulted from an undetected software problem and through possible misapplication of certain technical billing requirements. We are pleased to have reached a settlement of the matters raised in the amended complaint and note that at no point did any of the allegations involve questions about the quality of care provided to patients at DUHS facilities. DUHS has a robust corporate compliance program and is committed to the highest standards of ethics and integrity in all of our interactions with governmental healthcare programs. And related to this article, there's a by-the-numbers section. $1 million settlement agreement. $2.5 billion DUHS net patient revenue in fiscal year 2012 to 2013. $184 million DUHS operating income in fiscal year 2012 to 2013. And $709 million DUHS revenue from Medicare, 29%. The next section on this page is Hoops Corner. None of the Triangle's universities advanced out of the first weekend in this year's NCAA men's basketball tournament, but by hosting some tournament action, the Triangle should at least reap some rewards by visitor or in visitor spending. $5.5 million direct visitor spending during 2008 tourney, 11,000 total visitors in 2008, 12,500 hotel room nights in 2008, $164 price of an average tournament ticket at PNC Arena below the national average of $222, according to Prime Sport, the official ticket and hospitality provider of the NCAA. And here's a quote. I'm not saying that's what the numbers will be this time, but I'm guessing it will be in that ballpark. And that's a quote from Scott Dupree, Executive Director of the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance. And finally on this page, there's an ACA update. North Carolina factors big in ACA sign-up stats. That's the Affordable Care Act. North Carolina is one of a handful of states and one of the few controlled by Republicans that will play a big role in determining if the Obama administration reaches its goal of signing up 6 million people for health insurance by the end of the month, according to an analysis by Kaiser Health News. 10 large states, 7 of which are Republican-controlled, hold 30 million uninsured, nearly two-thirds of the nation's 47 million uninsured. In North Carolina, more than 200,000 individuals have selected a marketplace plan, or almost 19% of the number of potential marketplace enrollees, as estimated by the Kaiser Family Foundation. And our next reporter page is that of Dawn Curry, who covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. The first headline, So You Want to Open a Brewery? Many have dreamed of opening a craft brewery, but a successful launch depends on many factors, including the legal details. There are about 100 ways to run afoul of some law, statute, ordinance, or something, and only a very few ways to get it right, says Raleigh lawyer John Simankiewicz, who has put together a guide to walk would-be brewers through the process, which is available through the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild. The basics of starting a brewery aren't too much more than starting any business, he says, except that you also have to add on requirements from the Tax and Trade Bureaus, TTB, federal law, FDA, the ABC, state law, and zoning restrictions, local ordinances and requirements, and that can make the process seem daunting. In addition to local zoning hurdles, state requirements must be met as well, such as applying for a revenue license, setting up state excise tax accounts, obtaining label approval, and receiving state retail and commercial permits. On the federal level, brewers must identify the type of operation they will run, determine their federal tax rate and payment method, and register with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The legal process can be long, tedious, and complex, says Szymankiewicz. You'll also need funds, which can come from an investor and serial entrepreneur such as David Gardner, founder or co-founder of Triangle Companies ProviderLink, Report2Web, DB Basics, OnSphere, and PeopleClick, the last of which sold for $100 million. Gardner chats about his investments in Triangle Breweries. And in a related section is that chat with David Gardner, and it's headlined, Why Invest in a New Craft Brewery? David Gardner was an early investor in Summit Vora's venture with Lone Rider Brewing Company, and also invested in Cary-based Fortnite Brewing Company. I chatted with him about how a craft brewer might garner his attention. What would attract you to invest in a brewery? Most people want to start craft breweries as a hobby and don't necessarily want it to be big. But for investors, we want to see a return. We're going to look at it as a manufacturing investment. But what if you go big, invest a bunch of money, and the beer doesn't do well? I'm sure there are a bunch of breweries that don't make it. You have to brew large batches to navigate the space. You can generally sell all the craft beer you can make. If you go out to a restaurant or a pub to commit to a tap and don't keep it full, they will get rid of you. We encourage Fortnite to be big so we can deliver or on whatever the demand may be. So why did you invest in Fortnite? It was opportunistic. I knew the guys and I loved the concept of an English ale, and there wasn't a brewery in Cary, and I knew I could put the money together. They put a big tap room on and got a location on a busy road near a neighborhood community. The brewery actually covers all the expenses for the tap room. It really takes the pressure off of you when you're cash flowing. The day we opened, we cash flowed. And the final article on this page is headlined, Pinehurst Gears Up for U.S. Open. With 2 months until this country's national golf tournament at Pinehurst, things are starting to look a little different around town. Around 400,000 people are expected to attend the U.S. Open June 12 through 15, and the Women's Open June 19 through 22. The last U.S. Open at Pinehurst in 2005 drew about 325,000 people, according to organizers. Take a drive through Pinehurst past Pinehurst No. 2, the site of the two U.S. Opens, and you'll see changes such as fencing between the concourse and the road, and white trailers on the course that have been brought in to support the tournament. You'll even see those trailers parked around the tennis courts at the course's clubhouse. All the hotel rooms in Moore County are booked by players and their families, championship officials, and members of the international media, according to the Convention and Visitors Bureau for the Pinehurst, Southern Pines and Aberdeen area. However, houses in the village of Pinehurst and surrounding areas are still available to rent. First week rental prices range from $10,000 to $50,000 for houses in Pinehurst, with houses in surrounding towns priced slightly lower. Once the tournament is in full swing, a leisurely drive through Pinehurst will not be possible. With entry roads closing, visitors will be bussed in. Tickets go on sale to the general public June 10. They will be available on the U.S. Golf Association's website. Daily tickets for the gallery start at $30. Weekly tickets start at $125. And now we have the page of Lauren Onsorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. And the first headline, Ladies and Gentlemen, Rev Your Startups. Robots, fitness supplements, and honeysuckle beer. It's that time of year again. On March 19, a bracket-style competition that matches entrepreneurs from ACC schools against each other, pitch for pitch. Eight schools with 14 teams of hungry entrepreneurs made presentations at NCSU's James B. Hunt Library. Judges, who included Feel Good's co-founder Mark Syed and Blackstone Entrepreneurship Network's Cheryl Waddell, had some decision-making to do. Would the winner be Charles Culbertson and the team from NCSU? Their Thermaflow Solutions aims to sell a new product for analyzing particles in clinical testing, one that, unlike what clinical research organizations use today, analyzes without fluorescence, meaning cheaper, timelier results. Or Duke University's SF Robotics, led by Fabio Berger, Sarush Poor, and Alex Brown. Their 3D-printed robotic arm was just the start of their plan, Berger told me. The goal was to create a full-sized robot that could be printed and assembled for $3,000 to $4,000 and programmed to do everything from fold laundry to vacuum. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill presented CommuniGift, a startup that helps you buy wish list items for needy families. Clemson University's offerings included the crowd favorite, South Yeast Labs, which develops yeast for beer, and InQ Basic, which is developing a warming device for newborns in developing countries. First place went to Georgia Tech's CheckDroid, which aims to make Android easy for developers. The grand prize includes a pitch trip to Silicon Valley and a 9-month residency at Raleigh's New Living and Entrepreneurship Initiative, The Think House. And in the By the Numbers section, related to this article, 5%, that's how much of the annual venture funding goes to women. 35%, that's how much more return on investment female-led teams achieve. 12%, that's how much more revenue venture-backed female-led teams generate than male-led startups. These numbers from the Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy are driving a new initiative at American Underground in Durham. And in another article, the headline, Epic Games Looks at New Ways to Capture Gaming Revenue. For Cary-based gaming giant Epic Games, the past 2 years have been a stack of departures. First, it was the designer behind the Gears of War franchise, Cliff Bleszinski. Then it was longtime president Mike Capps, and earlier this year it was the franchise itself as Microsoft acquired the flagship Gears of War. But CEO Tim Sweeney says he's more energized than ever. Expect the new Epic, he says. Speaking shortly after the Unreal Engine 4 launch at the Game Developers Conference in California, he says Epic has more than one trick up its sleeve. As one generation moves on, a new generation of game developers are really stepping up and defining the new Epic, he says. And that Epic isn't just about a game franchise. Epic is branching out, allowing anyone to access its engine for $19 per month while collecting 5% of royalties from the resulting products. He stresses that it's not an entirely new concept for Epic. While he didn't give the current breakdown, some years the engine already carries the revenue over game sales, he says. The gaming industry is very cyclical, he says. But he doesn't see the two units as mutually exclusive. Our technology powers our games, and our game development efforts inform our technology, he says, adding that without the game making, Unreal Engine wouldn't be as capable. As far as game making, Epic is planning to release a title called Fortnite, which allows gamers to build their worlds by day and fight zombies by night. Sweeney says to expect news about that new title in the coming months. And finally, on this page in the They Said It section, data is spewing from everywhere, but it is useless without analytics. That's a quote from Jim Goodnight, CEO and co-founder of SAS and Carry, speaking at the SAS Global Forum in Washington, D.C. I would love to do some gimmicky thing. I personally can't because of the process, but you can. And that quote is from Gail Roper, CIO of the City of Raleigh, when asked if she was planning anything gimmicky to attract Google Fiber to the Triangle. And now we turn to the Entrepreneur's Corner section. The headline, it's a bike, it's a car, it's super green. And this article is written by Lauren Onsorge. A flash of orange whips by in downtown Durham. Legally, it's a bicycle, although you might not know it. A rounded, plastic-like pod guards three tricycle tires and the driver. There are pedals, but you don't have to use them. I use them downhill, laughs Rob Cotter, Organic Transit CEO and creator of what he calls the ELF, short for Electric, Light, and Fun. The futuristic 150-pound vehicle takes a 7-hour charge of sunlight, or 90 minutes via outlet, and takes off at 30 miles an hour. It gets the equivalent of 1,800 miles per gallon, and it sets you back nearly $5,000. Cotter, a Maine native with a Porsche background, says he's in Durham to stay. It's where his manufacturing facility is, a renovated warehouse space capable of creating 20 per week, although the actual weekly total is far less. Cotter, ever a businessman, says he has to balance production with demand. So far, there are conversation pieces for collectors, such as comedian Jerry Seinfeld. Google's Silicon Valley campus has three of the vehicles, and since they can park everywhere a bike can, they are meeting delivery needs of firms such as a New York City organic juice company that just ordered 40. Part of the growing industry of smart bikes, Organic Transit is beginning the transition from conversation piece to niche-filling transportation solution. It's increasingly popular in Canada, Cotter says, where people want a bike that can protect and function in a winter storm. Thousands of smart bikes are already on the streets in China, where pollution is a front-and-center topic, but they don't bear the Organic Transit label. So I asked Cotter, why not just move to China? Because, he says, part of the point is to innovate. We want to create a market, he says. While he admits the United States mainstream might not be ready to pedal its way to work, he says they will be, and he'll be here when they are. Cotter, who already has a service facility in San Jose and is opening another in Portland, is scaling up manufacturing. He's just hired a new general manager, Apoorv Agarwal, who comes from Ford's Advanced Vehicle Division. He's also an expert in zero-emission vehicle credits, Cotter says. That's the kind of money that fuels Tesla. Cotter is launching a sales and marketing strategy hoping to quadruple last year's output of 300 vehicles with a second manufacturing location, his preferred location, the Triangle. Organic Transit now employs 20 and is planning another Kickstarter campaign, this time for an ELF pickup truck. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the company spotlight. 100 Years as an Industrial One-Stop Shop is the headline, and this article is written by Don Curry. When C.A. Dillon Sr. opened Dillon Supply Company in 1914 on West Martin Street, downtown Raleigh, there were three employees: Dillon, a bookkeeper, and a general handyman. Dillon, a Petersburg, Virginia native, had settled in Raleigh and married Annie Lee Wynn, whose banker father helped Dillon go into business. Today, the 100-year-old Dillon Supply Company brings in $200 million in annual revenue, with 260 employees and at least $50 million in steel inventory alone. C.A. Dillon Jr., who also spent 50 years as the voice of the Wolfpack at NC State University's Reynolds Coliseum, took over the company when his father retired. Dillon Jr.'s son, Eric Dillon, is now vice president. "We were the largest machine shop on the East Coast before 1950, says Eric Dillon. Dillon put in the most boilers and textile and tobacco plants. The specialty things we did are now handled by specialty shops, but the guys who started those, we trained them. I remember in the mid-80s when our first fax machine came in, it cost $900 and had thermal paper. I thought, this will never last. Today, most of our orders still come by fax." In the early days, the company was a one-stop hardware shop for anyone working in the agricultural industry, blacksmithing or sawmills. During World War I, military efforts were supported with equipment and hardware, which allowed Dillon Supply Company to expand into a building on Southwest Street in 1992. During the 1920s, the company was building its customer base by supplying equipment for the textile and tobacco industries, and did relatively well until the Great Depression of the 1930s, says current president Dean Wagner. "The company really suffered and almost went out of business, but then began to thrive again, and in 1925 they opened a store in Durham," says Wagner. And I'm afraid we're going to have to stop right there with this article as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, but be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.